Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey everybody, it's Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's a great pleasure having you back in the house in what has been a very solemn week, one in which we've seen the national protests not pause so much, but I think out of respect for the ceremonies around the burial of Mr. George Floyd, people really took time to sort of process all of that. And we want to talk about what it means and how it has impacted so much of our lives in the last 3 weeks or so, and what it may mean going forward. So sit back, relax, because I really think you're going to get a kick out of my guest today. As someone I've watched from afar for a long time and watched her stir up the pot in sports, but then she got personal, and she stepped outside of that box, and people were like, "What? You can't do that?" And she's like, "Yes, I can." Jemele Hill, contributing writer for The Atlantic and host of the podcast Jemele Hill Is Unbothered. And yes, folks, she is one unbothered sister. Let me tell you, you can catch her on Spotify. She previously worked for nearly 12 years with ESPN, where I'm sure a lot of you watched her work and listened to her voice hosting their show, His and Hers. Jemele, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. This is a real honor.
Oh, no, honor's mine. You know, it's, I wanted, before we get into some of the obvious stuff related to your professional background and how that is playing out in this current civil rights moment, I want to start the conversation from your perspective, processing the last 3 weeks, coronavirus, the economic collapse, and now the civil unrest around the murder of George Floyd. As a black woman, who, you know, at the end of the day, you have to navigate the space as a black person, no matter what your profession, no matter what you do. I tell people all the time, you know, when you walk out the door, you're still black, and you may be, you know, the king of industry, the captain of industry, the queen of industry, or whatever your field is. But at the end of the day, you still have to reconcile with what all of that means. How have you done that? How have you processed this time?
Well, I think it just kind of highlights why being a black journalist comes with a different layer of difficulty than our white counterparts have, because as you just mentioned, you're already processing a lot of this just as a black person who lives in America.
Right.
But then you have to take how you're processing it and put it in perspective for people, particularly if you have a platform like I do, where, you know, I'm writing for The Atlantic, I'm appearing on a bunch of different news programs to talk about what I'm seeing and trying to contextualize this for, you know, for years to come. So when history looks back, you know, they'll look at the people who contextualize the moment. So you're living in two separate worlds, because when you're kind of diagnosing this as a journalist, you know, you're wearing a completely different hat, but that doesn't really separate you from the pain generally you're experiencing as a black person sifting through this trauma of knowing what has been the fate for too many people who have looked like you. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself just feeling like a lot of us have felt, which is pure exhaustion. Exhaustion, not just from seeing what happened to Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, and also Christian Cooper, even though he obviously did not meet the same fate as those three, is still very much tied into this overall experience that we continually have had with the police in our community and with, you know, white people by extension, obviously. So we're thinking about it in that way.
Right.
And then we're having to, you know, just put this in context for the world and explain to the world. That's the other part of it, is that, you know, Black people have been talking about race forever.
I was like, right? Why we got to keep explaining stuff that's exactly. So damn obvious?
it's like, but it also in that explanation is what we're talking about when we talk about white privilege. It's like the privilege of being able not to know is what it is. It's like you know, somebody told me this a long time ago, and at first it kind of didn't make sense, but as I've lived and experienced more, it started to make a lot of sense, is that white people can go their whole lives not knowing anything about Black people.
That's right.
And be perfectly fine.
We don't have that luxury.
We don't have that luxury. We got to know about y'all. All right.
Yep.
And we have to know. And so this exposes that two Americas of, you know, how we're living, is that, okay, we can tell you a lot of things, and we've experienced, you know, we're often only the only Black person in the room full of white people. We're often in situations where, you know, we're, as the Southern Black folks say, where we're the fly in the buttermilk. Mm-hmm. Like that's our existence, mm-hmm. You know, particularly if you're a professional, right? They are never in that experience. And so they've never been forced to learn these things. So you find yourself that at this point, in this crucial point in history, having to teach very basic things like, okay, let's start with the basic. Do you know who won the Civil War? Okay, we can go from there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because if you get that one wrong, then we're going to have a long...
But you know what? Look, do not make any assumptions, because I tell you, this allegiance to the Confederate flag has me wondering, like, y'all do know who won, right? Okay. Just checking. Okay. All right. And what they were fighting for.
And in any other world, that flag would not have nearly the prominence it has, because it's a sign of treason. It's a sign.
Exactly.
And these white folks running around wrapping themselves in the Confederate flag as they claim to be American. I'm like, well, dude, that's a conflict of interest.
Totally. It's like, oh, they're the God. Flag of traitors. Like, do you not know?
And because they don't know their history, and they assume the history, you know, written by white folks is all about and just about white folks. And that's just not how it plays out. You've raised, though, in your opening here, some very interesting points. And one of them, so I want to peel back a little bit more on, is around this idea of the duality of the role certainly as a Black journalist. And I take note of the fact that in recent days, there has been some dust up as journalists have now sort of taken to actively participating in the protests. And some folks have sort of raised some concerns about that. I have, from the standpoint of, you know, if you're going to be objective and give me the news, then give me the news. If you want to be, you know, play your role as citizen and want to express your personal views, that's something else. But you can't do both at the same time necessarily, because of the general perception that if you're covering the story, you can't be in the story. How does that work in the context of being a Black professional journalist covering a story like this that cuts so close to the bone for someone like yourself, who is well regarded in journalism and in the professional space, but nonetheless is still an African American woman who's impacted by the story?
So here's where I would sort of push back on that idea, because mm-hmm. I've seen that bubble up, and I understand, because you know, people clearly look to journalists to be objective, to give them the story and that sort of thing. So I understand that.
Right.
The difference and why this has to be a little more nuanced viewpoint is because that us being a journalist doesn't separate us from the things that we experience as Black people, not even in our own newsroom. Because what you've also seen is a lot of pushback and a lot of very uncomfortable conversations taking place in news media outlets across the nation. Because how can we, as in the media, cover what we're seeing if our newsrooms look nothing like the people that we're covering? See, all the issues that are springing up as a result of what happened to George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor,
right,
are issues that are living and breathing inside these newsrooms. And so they can't be hypocritical and say, okay, we're going to cover all this stuff about race and what race means in America, and we have no Black journalists in our newsroom, or we have very few, or we have very few in decision-making capacity. Like, you're just like America. Like, you're not, there's no separation.
Right.
And so a lot of the things that Black journalists are speaking up about is a reflection of not just what their daily existence is, it's a reflection of their professional existence. And so that's why you're seeing a little bit more pushback and agitation. And that's what people have to understand about journalism, period, is like, it's a profession of disruption. This is what you do.
Right.
Disruption doesn't mean you're an activist, but disruption does mean that you accurately and fairly raise certain questions, because in racism, there's no other side. Like, in most things that we cover, there's another side. There's like, oh yeah, you know, we're debating healthcare.
But wait a minute. Jamel, Trump told us they're good people on both sides.
You're right. Very fine people. Right? So that's what I'm saying, is that, like, we keep seeing, and this is part of the reason why racism, we have these stop starts when it comes to it. We see progress, and then the progress is blown back by just unbelievable, pushback. We see this because we keep framing racism as a debate, which is intellectually dishonest. We haven't done our jobs with how we've covered race in America. And that's why you're seeing more Black journalists be vocal, because we know that, especially if you're in mainstream media, we know we have not as in the Black journalists, as an industry, has failed. The Kerner Commission, when it came out with their report following the riots in the 60s,
right,
which addressed what was happening in the newsrooms, how they were mostly white, the lack of coverage, the lack of context, that has not changed. I mean, when I was in 2005, I was still in newspapers, because before I got to ESPN, I was a print news reporter and columnist for about a decade. And I worked in Detroit, I worked in Raleigh, and I worked in Orlando. When I was in Orlando, I was the only Black female sports columnist at a daily newspaper in North America. I didn't just say America. North America.
North America, just so we're clear of location.
Just so we're clear, yes. I was one out of 405. Now, we see what the sports, especially the major sports, look like. You know, the NFL, 70% Black. The NBA, primarily Black. College football, all these things. How am I the only one? In 2005, it has not changed since I left. Okay,
really?
I don't even know that there's one in daily newspapers now that's a sports columnist. So the lack of progress that has been there in media is why you're seeing Black journalists take on maybe what looks like an activist role to outsiders, but it's really them taking on the role of what was always the genesis of our profession, which was disruption.
So you dropped some knowledge here I don't want to lose sight of, and I wrote it down so I won't forget to come back to it. But I want to dig a little bit more into the point you just made about that very fine role between the Black journalist as a journalist, and then, of course, as a Black person. So don't you run the risk, or do you feel you run the risk of impacting your credibility as a professional individual? In other words, if I come to Jamel, and I know Jamel is an opinion writer, or you are the host of a show in which you throw down every week, and your view is your view, that's one context. And I understand that when I come into that relationship, I understand what that means. So that's your opinion. I can take it for what it is and move on, right? But if you then come to me as someone who's going to tell me the narrative of something and explain the who, what, where, when, and how of it, but then you put your own sort of flavor into it with your own color and your own texture, don't you run the risk that when I get that information and I realize that, well, it's not just the who, what, where, when, and how, but it's also what you personally believe, that I'm like going to look at you a little less credible? Or do you think that that builds the credibility because now you're sort of flavoring it with some real life experience or some a different perspective, to put it that way.
I think it you run the risk of undermining your credibility when you don't speak what is the truth.
Okay.
And you know, the truth is that for a lot of what has been framed about how, not just how we view race in America, and you're referring to, but even just in simply how we cover things, we have to say what it is. A big thing, and you know this as somebody who is not just deeply embedded in political circles, but as somebody who's in commentary and mm-hmm. is a political expert and operative, is that the way the media has covered Donald Trump has been frankly shameful.
Yes.
And it has been this way from the beginning. And that's what I mean about the result of when you don't say what it is. And he's the biggest example of this, is that treated like a, you know, like a, like parlor entertainment, which is why
which
he
is
was
what
able,
it is.
Which is what it is, right? Like he was treated so non-seriously leading into, you know, leading into his presidential run or during the course of it, he was taken as a joke. So therefore he was never asked serious questions. That was a failure
right.
by the news media because they didn't call it what it is.
Yeah.
And then once he clearly became a serious candidate, and for that matter, once he's elected, when the president says something racist, you got to call it racist because that's what
that's
it
what
is.
That's what it is. That's
right.
And the thing, it was so funny how people tap danced around that very point, especially after Charlottesville. And then we got into shithole countries and a whole bunch of stuff after that. And people still tap dance and refuse to call the thing what it was in front of them. In other words, okay, you just said something racist. You've repeated it again. You're now tweeting out other racist stuff from other racists. So therefore, hello, you got to be a racist. But then people are like, well, no, we can't necessarily say that. I'm like, well, wait a minute. 1 + 1 = 2. And the press just kind of continued to play into that in a way that I think even now people still surprised at the stuff Donald Trump says and does. When I'm on air and I look, I'm saying, why are we still acting surprised that this man just said something crazy?
Yeah, exactly. And that was a failure by the media. And I'll tell you that when as his candidacy became more serious, the first people to kind of raise objections to this coverage were a lot of black journalists who were just
yes.
like, hey, wait a minute.
April Ryan.
April Ryan was one.
And my
so
girl.
That's what I mean. Yes. And that's what I mean about people have a tendency when black people are just speaking the truth to say, oh, y'all biased. I'm like, no, we're trying to get you up on something that you clearly have not seen.
Right.
And we're able to use our perspective, yes, as a black person, as an added benefit, which was always part of the rationale for why there needs to be more of us in newsrooms, because otherwise something like the 1619 Project doesn't get done.
So what happened? Yeah, you're right. Okay, you raised it. You're good. You keep going to these hot spots, and I love it. So 1619 Project, look at the reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the reaction to us telling our history. Not the white man telling our history. Us telling our history and say, okay, so you understand from our perspective, what we saw, what we lived, what happened. And then the response, the pushback on that was, well, you're making up history. That's not exactly how it played. Were we brought here on a boat in 1619 against our will? Well, yeah. So can we just start with that truth and go from there? Because
exactly.
The rest of this shit ain't been good since then. You know, that's
no. And they, I mean, again, this is part of what you said earlier about this blind spot that we've had when it comes to our own history. It's almost like the American PR machine has worked a little too well, because we've all been told since we were children that this is the greatest country on earth, and this is that we were built based off disruption and rebellion, and that's how America became a superpower. Yes, some of that is true. America became a superpower because they had people working for free for 400 years. So that was
well,
really how we built our economy.
But they stole the land first.
Yeah, but right. They stole the land first.
They had to steal the land first.
Then,
and then they bring in
people.
Somebody else to work it.
Exactly. And then they brought in somebody else. And it was like, oh, okay. So So even, you know, that was the beauty of the 1619 Project, because people were hearing for the first time about, you know, it's talked about very eloquently, because it's funny, I just listened to the podcast, you know, in addition to having seen the actual printed work. But,
right.
you know, it talks very clearly about how this was, it was based off a hypocritical idea. We writing all these flowery words about freedom and equality, knowing everybody ain't free, and knowing they only meant one part of the one subsect, white men. That's the only people they were talking about.
They were talking to a very minute class of folks here.
Not all y'all, just this group right here. Just these people.
So you got to understand that. Here's the knowledge you dropped, which I wanted to get back to, because I think you caused me to reflect, and I'm still reflecting. And I think that there's real power in what you said that I'm about to repeat. And because I want folks who are listening to sort of take this in, because I think this is a central part to the upcoming debate that we're going to have, whether people want to have it or not. You know, you said a little while ago, racism as a debate. And the words went by, and then something in my head went, whoa, back that up. Racism as a debate, that I think has been part and parcel of the problem, is that we come at this subject as if we're debating whether Proposition A or Proposition B should be what we do or what we promote or whatever. The debate over two competing ideas. There is no competing idea with racism, because it is an ugliness, a stain, if you will, that cuts right deep to the soul of everything you were just describing, how America's described itself. Yes, we're all these things, but at the end of the day, I can't take my eye off that big black dot, that big brown dot, that big, you know, this stain that's right here, on everything that you're wearing and pushing out to the public. How do we get off of racism as a debate and understand that racism is? You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. But so here's something that I had to accept, and it really was painful to accept this. I had to start accepting racism as intentional. And I think that's also a part of the deprogramming that we need to do in this country, is that we've often looked at racism as if just a result of just something that has just happened, just something that has been allowed to ferment and permeate our society. We never look at it as intentional. As we just talked about slavery was intentional. Jim Crow was intentional. Redlining was intentional. The Tulsa Massacre was intentional. And once we understand the intention, much like as we have these discussions about police brutality, the intention of the police was to do exactly what happened to George Floyd. And that may sound harsh, and for some people that sounds like hyperbole, but it's true if you know the history of what the police...
Well, and how police forces were originally formed. Post-Reconstruction was to keep the black man in check.
Correct. And so when that is the root, and that is the intentionality behind how they were formed, we act as if that was supposed to magically disappear, and it didn't. It just took on different forms because we never dealt with the intention. And so for me, once I started to process that way, it made all these debates, because that's what they turn into, about racism, it made me understand that the people still debating its existence, where it exists, how it exists, are people who have stakes in the game. These are people who want to see it frankly continue because it's to their benefit. And that is the part that I think white America is having really trouble dealing with, is that if you have not been intentionally anti-racist, you're basically an accomplice. That's pretty much what it is. You can either be one or the other.
Right.
And so once I understood it in those forms, it allowed me to have much more honest conversations about race, and to have to bring a different dialogue to it. And frankly, I think it allowed people to see it differently. Like, why did it take George Floyd to get to this point? Like, you know, you and I are both of a seasoned age where we saw Rodney King, right? Rodney King was when we thought that this would be a seminal moment and we'd finally be able to have these conversations, and it wasn't. And we can take, everybody can be taken through the years of different instances where we've seen this thing happen. Amadou Diallo, like, there's a long list of names. So why was it George Floyd? And I realized that with George Floyd, as shameful as it is to think of it this way, he was the first one, or one of the few ones, where there was no "yeah, but." Yeah, but. Because there's always a "yeah, but." It's like, oh, Rodney King. Yeah, but, I mean, he was, you know, a criminal. Yeah, but, you know what I'm saying? It's always something that somebody
They tried that with George Floyd. And, you know, Candace Owens and others out there spewing all kinds of crazy stupid about him. And you're right. It didn't catch. It didn't stick because, and I think one of the reasons it didn't stick because we actually watched the man die.
Yes, and we saw the entire video. Because remember, that was the other favorite thing was, oh, but we don't know what happened before.
Right.
There was no before.
Right.
Like, so all those usual loopholes that people have relied on to try to disprove the existence of racism by the police were not there. And that just says everything about how racism had really turned into a debate, where we really had to sit up here and debate with people to stop killing us. That was what it was.
Well, right.
And it's just like, wow.
That's why what you said is, I think, so, you know, profoundly important, because it does go to the heart of a lot of things. You know, we have debates over whether or not we should have good schools. There's debate over whether or not we should get good paying jobs. We have debates over a host of things. So we had, you know, we have all these debates about things that relate to us, whereas with white folks, there is no debate. It just is. The expectation is that, you know, you're going to be born and you're going to go up and you're going to go to college. You're going to, you know, the line is very clear, and the expectations are very clear. And that's why the whole thing around the racism, for me, the way you put it, matters, because we have to stop treating it like it's a debate and treat it for what it really is what, you know, you're saying before, you know, the thing is what it is. You see what it is. You can't, you know, what we did with Trump, instead of just calling out what it is and what he's saying and what he's doing, stop dancing around it and have that that hard push at reality. And I don't know if white folks are ready for that, to be honest.
I don't think that they are, but when you look at across the board at the long list of things we're still debating as it relates to race, to me that speaks volumes. I mean, we're still debating pay equity. We're still debating this. It's like, why? Are
exactly.
We still?
Yeah. No, I mean, we still are.
We're still there. It's like, for as much of the progress that we've seen, we're still in many ways still at the basics. It's like pay equity, housing. We're still there. We're still debating these things. And it can be very frustrating. So a lot of what you've seen, I think, from Black people in this moment has been because we have been talking ad nauseum about these things for so long that it just is kind of mind-boggling to us that people are just waking up and saying, oh, we really do have a big problem. Yeah, we've been at one.
Right.
So it's kind of... So I just refuse to now have these debates about it. And I often ask people very simply, are you pro or anti-racism? If you're pro, I'd love to hear the argument. What's the argument? All right. You don't have one. So why are you treating this as if there is some benefit to police brutality? There isn't any. So, I mean, for anybody, you know, it's not just us. It's that you know, that's part of it, too, is like I think the people who are not affected by it mistakenly believe one day it won't be their turn. They think
See?
That it will just be us.
Yes.
One day,
no,
it's
baby.
Going to be your turn, right?
As King said, the arc of justice bends, you know, the arc bends towards justice. Yeah, but there's another side of that arc that also bends. What goes around comes around. And you got to be careful because you never know. I said this the other day. I was talking with a bunch of buddies of mine, and some of whom are very, very, you know, strong Trump supporters, and some white boys, and we were just talking, and I'm listening to this one guy kind of go on and on, and I looked at him, I said, "So what are you going to do when they come for you?" And he looked at me like, "What do you mean?" I was like, "Oh, you don't think that you're going to be clear just because you landed with Trump right now. When they decide to turn that thing around and point at you, what you going to do? Because we won't be here to back you up. Trust me, we are not going to be here to back you up. So what you going to do?" And they don't believe that they think that they're somehow immune from all of this. And I think, but to your point though, Jamel, I think that there are some who do worry about it, because that's the whole pushback on affirmative action, for example. So reverse discrimination. Now you're discriminating against the white man, and they get nervous when you start talking about a majority-minority country and what that may mean. So they're trying to lock down theirs now. So when we get to 2040-something, whatever that point turns, and there are more black and brown people in this country than there are white folks, as I like to say, as I like to point out to people, yeah, at that point, we'll just be South Africa. Right?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there is.
So that's why it matters now what we do.
Yeah, that's why it matters now that we dismantle the systems.
Right.
You know, I spent about a month in South Africa. This was during the World Cup in 2010. Mm-hmm. And the thing that struck me about it is that even though they always had, obviously it's a country that's majority black people. So they, from that standpoint, you know, they had something to work with, if you will. However, many of the systems that were erected during apartheid were still there.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why it's important that we disrupt and dismantle the systems now, because it doesn't matter what the numbers look like if the system is still working as it was designed, you know, to do. So add to your point, this is why this is important in this moment. I mean, the people, what's so ironic about this fear about how Trump is kind of like the last stand of the white folks, as many people have characterized it. What's so ironic about that is that it just proves our point. The point is that, you know, you're holding on to this thing. You're fear-based holding on to these things, to what you feel like is your deserve and stake in society, which only lets me know that you recognize that this society was racist. So that's why you don't want to trade places with us, because you know already what that means. So already you're acknowledging the existence and the presence of racism by your fear, because nobody wants to be treated like us.
No.
And so if that's the case, why are you treating us this way?
So the next 400 years is going to be a bitch for you.
Right. I'm like, you know, as the young woman, Kimberly Jones, who went viral.
Oh, my gosh. I'm desperately trying to get her to come on, because I was going to bring her up, as a matter of fact. Just an incredible moment. If you haven't seen it, folks, do check out her link on Twitter, Kimberly C. Jones, at Kimberly C. Jones. So go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. What I was going to say is, like, her last line that sticks with everybody was that people are lucky we're looking for equality and not revenge.
Yep.
That to me sums up everything. So in this whole fight is one thing that white people should recognize is that we've been awfully gracious. Awfully gracious.
Yeah. A little bit too much. That's why I tell people when I was growing up, one of the people I love quoting a lot was Malcolm X, which is rather hysterical. Particularly, I quoted him in a tweet last week, and you would have thought, I don't know what people were like, oh my God, it's a seventh sign. Michael Steele quoted Malcolm X. I'm like, dude, I've been quoting him since I was in my 20s. But, you know, we all need a little Malcolm right now, I think. And I think that's kind of what this moment represents in a lot of ways. We're going to take a quick break. And when I come back, I want to dance with you a little bit on something that you know a little bit about, and that's sports and how sports is now responding to this moment. We'll be right back with Jamel Hill right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, everybody, we are back talking with Jemele Hill, contributing writer for The Atlantic and host of the podcast Jemele Hill is Unbothered. And as you've heard so far, she's not bothered by much, which is a good thing, pressing up against the system. So, Jemele, you wrote a piece for The Atlantic, which I thoroughly enjoyed, particularly given so much about the NFL I love and other parts drive me nuts. And so the title was The NFL is Suddenly Worried About Black Lives. And in it, you make it very clear that they're not going to be able to have it both ways. And now come to the truth about racism, certainly the impact in sports and the treatment of Colin Kaepernick a little bit after the fact. Walk us through your story a little bit and tell us, where were you going with that?
So I always caution people about what to do in these moments of inconvenience, particularly as it relates to taking a stand or being on the right side of history. People don't forget when you fall on the wrong side. And it may, you know, as you mentioned earlier in this podcast, one of my favorite quotes by Martin Luther King Jr., when he talks about the slow bend towards justice, right? It is slow, and it is not always recognized when it's happening, or maybe even in that generation. But generations will look back and see how you treated something of importance. And the bottom line is that when Colin Kaepernick in 2016, when he chose to take a knee, by the way, he chose to take that knee because an Army Ranger, Nate Boyer, told him that is the sign of respect, is for fallen soldiers. And Colin Kaepernick made it clear multiple times from the beginning what his protest was about, and that he felt that America wasn't living up to its promise. He said he loved the country, had people who served. It wasn't about the troops and wasn't about the flag. Said that from the beginning. That's not the message everybody heard. And unfortunately, a lot of people were too intellectually lazy to go back and look at what he said. So, okay. In that moment, the NFL made a decision that they were not going to support Colin Kaepernick. They blackballed him from the league. They got to live with that. So to now come around 180 degrees and for Roger Goodell to have the nerve to sit there and apologize to black people, not mentioning Colin Kaepernick's name at all, and say that they support Black Lives Matter, Black Lives do matter to them, we're sorry we didn't listen to the players. You don't get a do-over, man. You don't get one. And it's like, there's nothing you can say. Exactly. There's nothing you can say that's ever going to make that right. Even if Colin Kaepernick were signed by a team tomorrow, it's still not going to make it right, because you cost this man 3 years of his career. Okay. And it's just for what? And what it came down to is that public opinion shifted. We're all in this moment of where there's incredible support and understanding and realization and a consciousness and awakening happened in this country. So you jumped on the bandwagon, and that's what it was. When it wasn't so convenient, you chose a side, and I'm not going to let you forget it. And a lot of people won't. And so that was what I walked everybody through in that column, is the just utter hypocrisy that the league has shown. And to take things further, Roger Goodell was the only one you heard from. You haven't heard from any of the 32 NFL owners.
No, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? You have not heard a peep from the owners.
No, and I think that is intentional, because they already made it clear where they stood by not choosing to sign Colin Kaepernick, by many of them. I'm looking at you, Jerry Jones, who the same guy who signed Greg Hardy, who was convicted of domestic violence.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Who we read in awful police reports, saw the pictures of him trying to kill his then girlfriend in a bathtub.
Right.
All right. He signed that guy. And he had the nerve to tell people he would bench any player that chose to take a knee for racial injustice. Just let that sink in. So the owners have already made it clear. Jerry Jones is very good friends with Donald Trump. They've already made it clear with the number of them that have donated to Donald Trump's campaign, who have during the moment of when they needed their support, they already made it known where they stand. And that's why you haven't heard from them, because I suspect they still feel the same way they did in 2016 when Colin Kaepernick took a knee.
And that's an interesting point, because and I'm glad you raised the Trump piece, because I was going to ask you, did you think that this reticence, this silence by the owners now versus their fake outrage in 16 was driven by the way Trump positioned himself between Kaepernick and the NFL? Absent that, do you think the NFL would have been a little bit more forthcoming in standing with him and understanding what Kaepernick was doing? Now, granted, the NFL is not the NBA, where the players have a great deal more leeway to express their personal views, et cetera, in you know, outside of their profession. Not so much with the NFL, which tends to be more than old school. It's hard school. I mean, it's just kind of a lockdown mindset. How do you judge that in your years covering sports and these big personalities like, you know, a Kaepernick? How did they operate in that space when the owners were so much on them? And would that have been a little bit different at that time if Trump had not sort of instigated or pushed those owners to respond the way they did?
So here's a very big difference between the NBA and the NFL that motivates and why these leagues feel so different to people. The NBA, everybody has a guaranteed contract.
Okay. Yeah,
in the NFL, they do not.
Yeah,
it's an owner-driven league.
Yeah,
and the owners often use their immense financial leverage with the players to do what they did to Colin Kaepernick. Is that there's only so many spots on a team. They know that if they cut somebody tomorrow, there's going to be 10 guys lined up to take that person's place.
Right.
Because that's just the way the league, you know, the way the league works. LeBron James is once in a generation.
Okay, right.
So you can't mess it up with that guy. All right.
Right.
So
right.
Therefore, he is, I jokingly call him the commissioner of the NBA, but that just speaks to the level of power and influence that he has in that league, because he single-handedly can drive television ratings up. He can drive them down. The NFL is football by its nature is conformist. It's about, you know, one team, one fight. So, there is the different dynamics are why you sometimes see the behaviors by the players of being much different. So with that being said, I knew that the moment at that rally, when I believe it was in 2017,
right? Uh-huh.
Yes. When Donald Trump said Colin Kaepernick's name, his fate was sealed. It was sealed right then. And unfortunately, because too many people had allowed Colin Kaepernick's message to be hijacked by patriotism, fake patriotism.
Yeah, I was going to say fake patriotism. I agree with that,
yes,
fake patriotism.
Because his movement had been hijacked by fake patriotism, the owners decided that it was much better to stand down to Donald Trump, because he was going to, you know, it's very few issues that Donald Trump has had that have been universally liked. All right.
Right.
And because the message had been hijacked, he was finding that he was getting a lot of support by coming after Colin Kaepernick, turning this into a conversation about patriotism. And so therefore, he found a hit. He found a hit song, and he was going to play it until he couldn't play it anymore. And
right.
The owners knew this. And so they thought the best way to eliminate Donald Trump from playing that hit was to sacrifice Colin Kaepernick. And Jerry Jones, you know, when Colin Kaepernick brought the grievance against the league, part of the reason why he essentially won this grievance is because Donald Trump gave him all the receipts.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Jones even testified in his deposition. He said that Trump told him personally that this was a winning issue for him. And that is what changes. Stephen Ross said this to the media. Stephen Ross, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, he said that he was with the players until Donald Trump started talking about the league and Colin Kaepernick, and that changed his mind, and that's why he took a stronger position against them speaking out. So what does that say? The league allowed, you know, the NFL, which generally, let's be honest, because of their position in the marketplace, because this is a league worth billions and billions of dollars, it's the most popular sport in America, typically they are not known for bending and cowering.
Right.
They don't do that. But in this case, they did because they felt like the president's megaphone, his bullhorn was louder than theirs. And it was during a time where there had been some ratings drop in professional football, which I know people love to blame Colin Kaepernick and the protests for that. But really, it was a result of the fact that Peyton Manning had retired. If you look back at the schedule, it wasn't a lot of great marquee games. Because if people really hated football, then, you know, I think it was that year, the Cowboys Green Bay might have been like the highest rated game of the year. Then people wouldn't have been tuning in across the board. But strangely enough, this is a weird concept. When it was better games, a lot of people watched. I know it was shocking. So, So I say all that to say is that, you know, the owners took a very cowardly position because they were afraid of. They were afraid of the blowback. They were afraid of Donald Trump. They were tired of the narrative that Colin Kaepernick, the player protests, were turning off sports fans. And so they took the easiest path. And this is all tied into these statements that these teams have been putting out, Roger Goodell itself, why I can't take it seriously, because you had your moment to prove otherwise and you didn't.
Well, it's interesting because you set up perfectly the contrast between sports being impacted by Colin Kaepernick in 2016-2017 and sports being impacted by George Floyd in 2020. So as you just laid out very clearly and succinctly what happened in the NFL and how that bounced around and impacted other aspects of sports, the fan base, certainly for the NFL, largely white male NASCAR kind of vibe, Confederate flags, you know, honk, honk, all of that, trashing the African-American with a big afro on his knee, quote, disrespecting the men and women who died for the freedom of this country and his freedom to play this game under that flag, which was total bull because that was not what that was about. So now you have George Floyd and the consequences that have come out from under his murder. And the sports world is finding itself in a very different position. That once, you know, bravado from NASCAR, certainly what we saw in answer to, for example, the Confederate flag in South Carolina after the Charleston killings in 2015, where they, you know, okay, we can lower the flag and we'll take it down, but we'll put it back up. They went back to the same old, same old. You have Bubba Wallace, who is the only African-American driver in NASCAR's elite sort of Cup Series, calling for recently this week for the removal of the Confederate flag, and NASCAR was like, "Okay, no problem, we'll do that." And then LeBron James, just in the last 24 hours, talk about his megaphone and using that power, refusing to stay silent off the court. Has now come out with other black athletes and entertainers to form More Than a Vote, which is an effort that encourages not only African Americans to vote, but to expose voter suppression and you know, misinformation, all that related to voter suppression. Very different environment in sports from what we saw just 4 years ago. What accounts for that change, do you think, where Colin Kaepernick, for whatever you may say or think about him and that moment / movement, actually stands out and as sort of a seed, if not the father of what I think you see now? But maybe you disagree. I don't know.
No, I don't disagree with that. I think he encouraged a lot of people to begin to use their voices, and it worked in both good and bad ways. It worked in good ways because a lot of athletes, I think, found their power or felt more urgent about contributing to their communities and looking around the world and see what was happening around him. But unfortunately, because his career was sacrificed, it also became an example of the cost of speaking out.
Right.
And so I think at first he started to engineer a lot of people beginning to get involved, but then it quieted because the protests actually had kind of started to dissipate and go away. That's not to say the efforts behind the scenes did, but the outward showing of unrest started to go away because people saw what happened to Colin. And then, you know, now we see them saying, you know what, we see the cost of being silent. Now, LeBron James was different because his positioning in sports is much larger. He's a right. transcendent athlete. He has a, you know, nobody's not going to want to be in business with LeBron James.
Right.
So he has leverage there that he's used throughout his career in good ways, especially the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years of his career in particular, that he's used in very positive ways to speak to these issues. And so what I think you're seeing now is more obstinance and refusal by Black athletes when it comes to, you know, being silenced and being suppressed, their voices being suppressed. They're just not having it anymore because they've seen the other side of this. And I think many of them in hindsight now regret not standing firmer with Colin Kaepernick. And but this also proves why he was always such a threat to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing. And this is why I tell people who I understand, yes, you have to have action with whatever truth you're speaking. The action must support it. Colin's actions always did, beyond just the kneeling. He was always very active in the community. He put his money and his time and effort behind everything that he was saying and doing publicly. He did that. However, the reason why he was such a threat to the NFL is because of the other players he could bring along with him without saying anything.
Yeah.
And that's why he was a threat, because he was the leader of it. Even though other players kneeled, and people point to the fact that Michael Bennett kneeled and, you know, he was still employed, and they try to use this as an example that he wasn't blackballed. Yeah, it's true that the others, some kneeled and didn't face any consequences, but they had to cut the head off the snake. The head was Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
And so it was much, they have a much different view of him in this as that leadership role. And so what you're seeing, I think, from LeBron James is just the extension, as you said, the them taking Colin Kaepernick's seed that he planted and trying to make sure that they bear really substantive and impactful fruit, because this is go time. The election's coming. And one thing, even though, yes, I miss sports like everybody else, but I think the games not being played is a really key piece of this. Because if the games are still being played and it was still business as usual in sports, there would still be that double-mindedness of, we got to stay true to the bottom line. I don't think you would see this level of, frankly, outrage by professional athletes.
Interesting.
I'm not necessarily talking about LeBron, because
right,
he's always
right.
been vocal. But the other ones, I don't know if you see this. What happened between Drew Brees and the president doesn't happen if football is being played right now. And I know it's the summer, so it wouldn't have been anyway. But
yeah, but if they were in camp and all of that was going on.
Correct. Wouldn't it have been speaking about the you know, when he had his original comments. I don't even know if that would have even been happening. But the games were going to be an easy distraction and also an easy excuse to not say anything. And so from that standpoint, I'm glad that sports wasn't here when this moment happened.
Wow. I hadn't looked at it that way. And that's why you're Jemele Hill. And that's why Hill is unbothered, right? Jemele, thank you so much. Oh my gosh, this has been a great conversation. I kept you longer than I promised, and I apologize, but it was just so good.
No.
And it's just, you know, folks like you who are in the crucible and are touching a lot of points that, you know, we don't get up close to sometimes. It's just nice to have you take a moment and share those insights. And I appreciate you doing that on the podcast today. I really, really do.
Well, thank you. This has been a great experience. And one of these days we'll have to catch up for real and face to face.
Yes.
I look forward to that. But this has been great. So it was no trouble at all to stay longer because I enjoyed the conversation just as much as you did.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. And I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it as well. Jemele Hill is the contributing writer for The Atlantic and host. And you got to check it out, folks. The host of the podcast, Jemele Hill, is Unbothered. And I think we figured out why. Real pleasure having her on. And thank you all for listening. Don't forget to do that voodoo you do when you download the podcast at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. Check me out on Twitter at Michael Steele. And check out Jemele on Twitter as well at Jemele Hill. Make sure you follow her and have some fun catching up with what she's up to. All right, folks. That'll sit for now. You guys be good, be safe, stay well, and we'll catch y'all next time.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.